This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark. Number one on the list of UN Sustainable Development Goals is to end poverty in all its forms everywhere. A lofty task, to be sure. But do we fully understand what it takes to lift groups of people out of poverty? Much of our efforts to tackle poverty has had to do with things like encouraging people to get better education, to save more, to learn to be more business savvy. These are no doubt well-intended programs, but what if that wasn't enough? What if poverty and simply being in an environment of scarcity makes it difficult for any person to change their situations? Eldar Shafir is best known for his work on how people's environments affect their decisions and thus their financial outcomes. He's a behavioral scientist at Princeton University and formerly a member of US President Barack Obama's Advisory Council on Financial Capability. Eldar, thank you so much for joining us on the show this morning.
It's a pleasure, Lynn.
Now, you've written a great deal about scarcity vis-a-vis poverty, and your proposition is, as I understand it, that poverty is hard for individuals to break out of due to a kind of scarcity mentality as opposed to a failure of character. Could you briefly explain some of the cognitive effects of scarcity?
Yes, so especially in the book that we wrote with my colleague, Samuel Moynihan, we talk about the psychology that emerges in context of scarcity. And the reason we use the word scarcity and not directly poverty is because in some interesting way, poverty is just one kind of scarcity. And by that, I mean, you can have people who are thirsty, you can have people who are lonely. And what you find is that when people have a real scarcity in a resource, a lot of our mental capacity, a lot of our mental bandwidth is dedicated to thinking about and managing and juggling this insufficient resource. One of the interesting behavioral findings about people is that we have very limited bandwidth. There are remarkable studies, for example, about people who use who are on the phone while driving. Forget hands. These are non-handheld phones. And still you find if you're driving and you're speaking on the phone, your ability to detect the periphery, your reaction time are basically comparable to somebody who in the U.S. would be considered legally drunk. We have a very limited capacity. And what we find is that when people in scarcity devote a large chunk of their mental bandwidth or the mental capacity to juggling the insufficient resource, they just have left less capacity for other things. And especially in context of poverty, when you have less capacity to pay attention to attend to other things, bad things happen. You forget to pay your bills. You forget to pay the parking meter. You get evicted when you're distracted by this excessive juggling.
So the idea that scarcity creates this kind of subconscious reactions, I mean, some would take this view as absolving people from individual responsibility as well. I mean, if I'm poor and my bad choices are due to my situation, which is to an extent beyond my control, then whose responsibility is it to help get me out of that situation?
Well, it's interesting you bring it up because, you know, I have a slightly different read on it, which is, you know, Americans, in fact, are very reluctant to give a lot of welfare programs because the idea is that people are responsible for their own predicament. This model really says something quite different. It means that you have people who are well-intentioned and capable. And if you don't provide the right context, if you put them in a context that's too overwhelming, they just can't make it. But what's so nice about this is that if you take people who are trying so hard and are responsible and are capable, and you simply allow them to thrive, they will. So, the metaphor we use in the book is imagine a cockpit. If you take the best pilots, the most well-intentioned pilots, if you designed the cockpit badly, people crash. Your responsibility as, a policymaker, as a government, is to take these capable, promising, well-intentioned pilots and put them in a cockpit that allows them to thrive.
Okay, so what then are the policy implications for tackling poverty if you also take into account the bandwidth tax that you mentioned?
Well, the implications are that what you need to do, especially for people in poverty, is what all of us get without even noticing. So those of us who are living a well and comfortable and good life in the 21st century get an enormous amount of help. We have lawyers and accountants and bankers and gardeners and all kinds of people who help us manage our lives. What's interesting, if you get to poverty, is that those people who need all this help a lot more than those who are doing well get a lot less of it. They have unreliable transportation. They have bad childcare. And so what you find, in fact, is that we're sabotaging the success of those who can do well. And the implication is if you take people who are struggling, you have to provide them, again, a good cockpit, a promising context. You have to make, you know, you have to give them reliable transportation, good childcare, after school programs, good access to food and to health. To the extent that you reduce my needs to juggle, we can also talk more about, you know, literally how to design the income stream. Mm. You know, if I make $1,000 a month, it makes a big difference whether I get those thousand every month or I get 2,000 one month and then nothing for 3 months. You know, the juggling gets a lot more complicated.
Is it actually possible then to just change the scarcity mentality without actually changing the conditions, in effect, the cockpit in your example?
Well, without changing, you know, of course, you can work on people and help them do better. But what we find is that to a large extent, the scarcity mentality comes directly out of cognitive demands. So, of course, I can, you know, I can leave you with high demand and force you to train to do things a little bit better. And in fact, what you find is that the poor are extremely efficient. For example, when they go to the supermarket and, you know, being very efficient with their funds and doing the best they can and getting the best price per unit item and all that. But that's a limit because, you know, if you look at a lot of the cognitive work that's been done on bandwidth limitations, you know, there's only so much you can do. If you design a cockpit badly, pilots can't typically train to attend to more they can attend to and they'll crash. They need a cockpit designed to human limitations. And in that sense, you know, the design of societal conditions, especially for those who are struggling without too much other help, needs to conform to human limitations.
So, Eldar, I know that you're not an economist, but having given so much thought into scarcity and having worked very much with Milena, then who's of course a Harvard economist, I wonder what your thoughts are then on proposals like universal basic income as a way of combating some of the most dire cases of scarcity, taking into consideration as well that many argue against UBI's citing it as a disincentive for people to get jobs.
Yeah, so, you know, as you say, I'm not an expert on the details. I've certainly read and thought a lot about it. You know, UBI has several problems with it. One of them is that it's just terribly expensive. And so when it gets to issues of budgeting and macroeconomic considerations, I don't feel, you know, really able to comment in depth. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very healthy debate because it raises issues that are critical for society to consider. Because, you know, instead of UBI, you could imagine, you know, BI. It doesn't have to be universal necessarily. Universal is really one step that's been proposed just to alleviate the resistance among those who find it not a good policy. But, of course, it would be a lot less expensive if we didn't give basic income to those who need it less. When it comes to incentives, I belong to those who think, and I'm by no means alone, it's quite standard, but most evidence suggests that the idea that people prefer not to work is way over extended and over hyped. In fact, most people, if you give them a good condition and the right wages, would prefer to work than not to work. Most people do not like to receive handouts that they don't deserve. So, you know, the image that in the US 20 years ago with the welfare queens that Reagan made famous, that image, which in the American mind is still very vivid, is in fact describes a very rare event. Very few people are really enjoying sitting at home getting government benefits and laughing about it. Most evidence is if you give people good benefits and good help, it typically helps them live better, get better jobs, put their kids in childcare and conduct their lives in better, more successful ways.
I'm speaking with Eldar Shafir, behavioral scientist at Princeton University and co-author of the book Scarcity: Why Having Too Little Means So Much. After this, a discussion on the different kinds of scarcity we are seeing during this COVID-19 pandemic. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill, where I'm speaking with Eldar Shafir, behavioral scientist at Princeton University and co-author of the book Scarcity: Why Having Too Little Means So Much. Eldar, let's also turn our attention this morning to COVID-19. How does the concept of scarcity feed into this time? I mean, most people would assume that, you know, scarcity and COVID-19, it would mean a kind of financial scarcity as a result of the economic instability that we're seeing. But that's not the only form of scarcity we can observe during this time, is it?
No. So, you know, the connections are multiple. And here, I'm getting into an area where we don't have a lot of data, of course. It's mostly just intuition. But, you know, for one thing, the number of people basically juggling scarcity has gone up significantly. So, you know, the U.S. recently has added 8 million people to the count of those who are below the poverty line, to give an example. And so obviously the number of people juggling has just gone up significantly. it's also true that if we talk about, you know, just bandwidth imposition, just the cognitive load that's put on people, a lot more people are functioning under load, just the basic concerns of how to, you know, manage the month, finish the year, how to plan, trying to resurrect their small businesses. These are all situations where all of a sudden a lot of load has been imposed on people. So that's kind of at the individual level. I think there's interesting effects, and nobody has studied them yet, but I think they could be kind of promising. In the U.S., there's a really strong streak of independence. I mean, you know, the idea that a lot of Americans were comfortable with the notion that a lot of citizens do not have health care is really quite striking for many people in the world. And I'm thinking that one thing that's going to happen from COVID-19 is this greater sense of dependence, the idea that really my health is not independent of the health of the person who's driving the bus to my kid's school. It's not independent of the person who delivers my groceries. It's not independent of my maid or my nanny. And I think the number of Americans now who would be comfortable with the thought that a lot of lower income people are getting no health care, hopefully will diminish.
And you also illustrated kind of some behavioral pitfalls that we may start to see appear during this pandemic. So things like being perhaps a little bit too bound to the status quo. Are there long-term effects as well if we kind of fail to address the behavioral pitfalls that may appear during this COVID-19 period?
Here, of course, we're, you know, philosophizing. It's too early to know what's going to happen. You know, one long-term effect that's going to be interesting to see is to what extent the younger generation, you know, has a perspective from now on where they wake up every morning and the world could change overnight. In some sense, many of us have been fortunate in the last few decades to feel pretty robust and safe and secure in some sense, at least in the West and in many other countries that have done well. This is really a different perspective. Yes, you're right. In terms of the everyday management of the pandemic, there are issues, everything from, you know, stigma to embarrassment. In the U.S., it's become very political. I think it's relatively unique in the world where the, you know, putting or not putting a mask has become a political statement. So there's a lot of stuff that's very myopic and kind of classic human psychology that just doesn't fit the moment in a good way and creates a lot of difficulty.
And I wonder if you could also help us understand the differences in levels of compliance to COVID-19 requirements like physical distancing and mask wearing from a behavioral science point of view. I mean, media reports have often painted Americans' fixation on freedom of choice and, as you said, independence as a key reason that there seems to be far more resistance to the new norms. Is there a way that we can use behavioral science to understand this and perhaps even reduce the instances like we're seeing around the world of protests against new COVID-19 measures?
You know, people have tried a lot of interesting insights and manipulations, and there's data, of course, in other studies where, you know, you do behavior change. How do you influence behavior? So to give you an example, you know, what your leaders do has an impact. So if our president walked around full time with a mask on, that would have an impact on the behavior of many people who endorse him and who follow him. The fact that he's chosen not to do that has an impact as well. There is, you know, norms that societies introduce, and some norms are very powerful. Very few Americans walk around without pants on, assume, you know, claiming that they have the freedom not to wear pants. The mask could be something similar. I mean, there's going to be a perceived norm where, you know, not wearing a mask is like coming around with no pants. It should be embarrassing. It's like walking around naked. So these are norms that societies can introduce. They don't emerge overnight, but over time they can. Other things you can do that kind of change the perception of what it means not to do something. You know, for a while, people were very resistant to wearing helmets if they were riding motorcycles or even seatbelts. These are things that initially look like an imposition. And then through time, especially through kind of changing what's the perceived norm, today, you know, if you're seen driving without a seatbelt or no helmet, it's actually seen as a minus, no longer a proud act of independence.
But I mean, you know, in the past, we have seen in the US and the UK about a decade ago, politicians coming around to the ideas of nudge policies made popular by law professor Cass Sunstein and economist Richard Thaler. Now, the idea is that governments may nudge people by making it easier for them to make good choices. But at the same time, some would say that that puts too much power in the hands of the government, right? So how do we strike that balance?
We're getting into a very deep issue that runs, you know, at the core of the kind of, you know, the discipline that I inhabit. And those are kind of your assumptions of, you know, the rational agent and what a person can and cannot do and how well people function. If you assume that people are, you know, well-functioning rational agents who have very clear preferences and do good cost-benefit analyses and have fantastic self-control and not to mention in some economic modeling, you know, close to infinite memory, and so on and so forth. If you assume all that, then you say, look, people know what's good for them. They're doing the right things. They're making good plans. What government should do is basically provide a well-functioning market, step away, and let people thrive. That's one vision. That's the vision that for a long time dominated sort of economic policy and policymaking in many governments. The behavioral, you know, contribution, revolution, whatever you want to call it, is try to alter that vision. It says that people are not that way. Not only do we have very finite and fallible memories, but we have bad self-control, bad planning, we have very inconsistent preferences. And then we have, you know, the emotions, the shame, the pride, the envy, all the stuff that interferes with everyday functioning. If you take that sort of agent, the agent who's highly fallible, and she doesn't always do the best things to create the highest well-being for her, and she, you know, doesn't save for retirement because she hasn't planned well, and she doesn't do her annual checkup enough because she forgets or is reluctant, in that world, people can use help. Now, it doesn't have to be fully government. It could be, you know, small organizations. It could be panels of experts. It could be non-for-profits. But in some sense, you know, people who are fallible that way could really use help to live a better life. And if you have that understanding and you know enough to know that if you don't step in, people will not take care of themselves the right way. They will retire with insufficient savings. They will not see doctors frequently enough in a certain age to do, you know, self-exams and other important tests. Then if you know this and you don't do it, in some sense, it's irresponsible. So to me, the politicians who claim leave people alone, don't interfere, if they saw the data and still say that, I think are doing something relatively irresponsible. Now, of course, you know, there's a real issue of paternalism here, and all of us have, you know, read Orwell, and we understand that there is an issue here, and you want to keep government, you know, limited. On the other hand, to say, you know, we step away, let people do what they want, is an act of irresponsibility if you accept the picture of people in a certain way. I'll give you an example, by the way, that's in my world of, you know, benefits and poverty is kind of interesting. The standard economic model says that if I give a benefit, say unemployment insurance or aid to children and food to parents who have insufficient income, et cetera, if I give some benefit, if I make the obstacles a bit higher, if I make the forms more complicated, if I require more, you know, longer lines, whatever I do that makes it a little bit more difficult, what's going to happen is that those who need it the least will stop asking for the benefit, and only those who need it the most will still keep coming. And so basically, by raising the obstacle, I select for only those who need the benefit the most. That's the standard theorizing. In reality, it's probably exactly the reverse. In reality, if you take the poor and you take those who need a benefit more and those who need it less, if you make the forms more complicated and more menacing, and you make the obstacles more difficult to override, those who need the benefit the most poor, will be the first to stop showing up. And if you think about that, what that means is that every time we impose these obstacles, we'll make the forms very long, we'll make the requirements very high, we demand a yearly recertification of benefit eligibility, all those moves that are assumed to get rid of those who are really using the system, in fact, are getting rid of many who need the benefit the most. It's just the wrong assumption about human behavior that totally changes how efficient your policy is.
And you've also touched on another kind of assumption of human behavior, particularly when it comes to those who are from lower income groups. And you've talked about this thick skin bias as well. I'm just wondering whether we will eventually start seeing a thick skin bias increasing along with the increasing wealth gap that we are seeing in both developing and developed countries.
That's a very deep observation. I haven't thought about enough about the, you know, the temporal logic here, but yes, you're absolutely right. So the thick skin bias is a very recent kind of project that we published, and it's really sort of a bias about us, not about the poor, although they're not immune to it. But the bias basically says that if you describe an unfortunate event, it could be anything from your grandma dying to being almost hit by a car to small things like being insulted or being caught in a rainstorm without an umbrella, being served bad food, you know, from major to minor. And you describe this to people, and the protagonist, the person who's experiencing this, is either rich or poor. People invariably, and by that I mean nationally representative samples, experts of all sorts, all think that the poor will have been less encumbered, less insulted, less inconvenienced, less upset than the rich. And that's why we call it a thick skin, because there is a sense in which, you know, after you've practiced, you know, small disappointments long enough, you're in some sense immune. You have a thicker skin. It doesn't hurt you as much. So that's a very powerful bias people have. I call it a bias because in many cases, it's simply wrong. So, you know, if you heap insults one on top of the other, if you get bullied in the school ground, you don't get used to it. It actually gets worse. And so in many cases in everyday life, the idea that we perceive the inconvenience when it happens to the poor as less alarming than when it happens to the rich has enormous policy implications. We just feel less of an urgency to help, even if we're well-intentioned. What's nice about all these discussions, by the way, is we're not assuming malice. We're assuming well-intentioned policymakers, well-intentioned people who just have a misperception or an assumption that's wrong. And it's leading them to be less efficient in their attempts to, you know, to design better policy or to help.
So in that sense, then, how do we become more aware, perhaps, of a thick-skinned bias in policymaking and avoid this well-intentioned policymaking from essentially falling by the wayside due to these misconceptions that people may have about the poor?
Well, you know, it's a question about debiasing techniques. And in some sense, paradoxically, it's easier to do in policymaking than in everyday life. So if you think about your perception and my perception of people, how to revise it is not always so easy in everyday life, because it comes and goes very quickly and it's intuitive. But the levels of government and policy, then, you know, policymakers have to ask, okay, here is our propensity to do the following to help a certain group. And then you can certainly ask, or you can even, you know, present a scenario to your colleagues. How would you react if these people were not poor? If they were, for example, wealthy, if they were, you know, the upper class and they suffered the same inconvenience, would we help more or less? So you can do these. If you're aware of the bias and you try to look for ways to de-bias, you could imagine running scenarios and running hypotheticals that lead you to realize, you know, in medicine, for example, it sometimes happens. Would I do the same procedure if the person was younger, if the person was older, if the person was white, if the person was black, in an attempt to de-bias yourself? And so one thing to do, for example, in this case, if I describe to you some disaster, you know, a mining disaster where people are hurt and we have to ask how much to help, I can, for example, hide from you the fact that they're poor, or even run a scenario where they're rich and see, does your propensity to help, does the empathy you show differ? And if it differs and you think it should not, well, that has very clear implications.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us this morning, Eldar. It's been a pleasure having you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Eldar Shafir, behavioral scientist at Princeton University and formerly a member of President Barack Obama's Advisory Council on Financial Capability. This has been The Breakfast Grill. I'm Lynn Mark, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.